Okay. So, let me give you some examples which show in which direction one can go further. Just one of the examples which I studied, well, exactly 20 years ago, and that is explains, for example, supersymmetric SU5, etc. Okay, so at that time it was a popular model. And in this model, there was a problem. The problem was that it had actually, if you take into account also a small Higgs field, there is about a dozen of minima which, before taking into account gravity, have exactly equal depth. And then at high temperature in the early universe, the only minimum that survives is SU5 minimum, because there is symmetry restoration at high temperature. So you are stuck in this SU5 minimum, and then somehow you must go to the minimum where we are right now. And it was a real problem, because at that time everybody took SU5 theory very seriously. But the problem is quite generic. These many minima in this model, in models like that, they quite often appear. So what would be a possible answer to this problem? And the possible answer would be, like, assume that this structure survives during inflation. So you have an independent field, which inflaton field, which produces jumps, quantum fluctuations. And these quantum fluctuations, as I described at the previous hour, they occur in all massless, nearly massless scalar field. And these fields, they have mass approximately 10 to 15 GeV. So if I have inflation on the scale of, well, close to the Planckian scale, which is true in the simplest model of chaotic inflation, then I have Hubble constant, which can be 10 to the 18, 10 to the 19 GeV. And I have here distance between one minimum and another only 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16 GeV. So during inflation, at each Hubble time, the universe would easily jump from one minimum to another. Okay, so even if we are initially we're sitting in this minimum, then very soon the universe would be divided into many domains with many different minima. And we are so interested in this model that actually we make computer simulations, which are called Kandinsky universe. So we started we started with the universe sitting in one of these minima, and then after several steps of calculations, okay, this describes the universe, which is exponentially larger than the block with which we started initially. The universe becomes divided into many domains with different, colors. Color indicate different properties. Here it is red, here it is green, and here is blue. Well, for historical reasons, we start with the red minimum, and then we jump all over the place. In fact, now I can confess you that this calculation, this particular one, was done, in fact, well, incorrectly. We make a very large step of calculations, and that is why these fluctuations become, well, too large. If we would do it more accurately, and we did it later, the picture became much more smooth. But it is so beautiful that I still continue showing this one. The fact is that after this set of jumps, the universe really becomes divided into different domains with different colors. So
I would have thought there were spherical bubbles growing. There's no sign of any spherical bubbles.
No. The spherical bubbles appear only in this first order phase transition story. And here is a completely different situation. There is no spherical symmetry whatsoever. Okay, it's not a tunneling, it is really, well, Brownian motion.
Okay. Yeah, Lenny
yeah. Because the idea which Lenny had is something like tunneling upstairs and tunneling through the barrier, whatever. So if you have tunneling through the barrier, then you have spherically symmetric bubble. If you have tunneling upstairs because of diffusion, now, the picture of tunneling is the following. It is, it goes, well, back to the old debate of what is the meaning of Hawking-Moss instanton, because Hawking-Moss instanton was a tool describing this tunneling upstairs during inflation. And it was nearly impossible to understand what Steve Hawking was talking about, because when he introduced it, I asked him, how come this Hawking most instanton looks like homogeneous tunneling, and are you saying that the universe really jumps homogeneously on the space, like in open universe, it's infinite universe, simultaneously jumps, how could it be? And he said, yes. And then half a year later, they, together with Moss, issued a larger paper on this subject where they say that, well, our statement was widely misunderstood. what we are talking about is nearly homogeneous tunneling within the scale comparable to the size of the horizon. Okay, and I was unable to understand neither the first paper nor the second one until Stravinsky came with a stochastic approach to inflation. I worked on it a little bit and, well, gave this interpretation which I had. And the meaning of what happens there, the meaning of the discussion which I gave at the previous talk, here it is. You have here this profile. You start, for example, by sitting in this quasi-de-Sitter space, okay? Now, you're sitting here. Let us assume that initially you are sitting exactly with a state with a given value of the scale of field phi. But then, next moment, you jump to this place locally. In one part of the universe, you jump here. In another part, you jump here. Then you tend to roll down, but you also has a possibility to jump higher or roll down, and then you solve this Brownian motion equation. What does it mean, all of these jumps? It means that at each moment of time, you are jumping more or less homogeneously on the scale of the horizon, because each new frozen mode is has a wavelength h minus 1. That is the moment when these waves are frozen, when the wavelength becomes larger than h minus 1. And then it continues being larger than h minus 1 because it exponentially expands. So the first wave jumps, it has this wave h minus 1, then on top of it, other wave jumps, and it also has wavelength h minus 1. And then it expands, and then on top of it, another jumps, it also has wavelength h minus 1. So all of this profile is approximately homogeneous on the horizon scale at each point, but it just takes different values everywhere. And now when we're talking about the tunneling, we're talking about this. It is possible that these fluctuations accumulate. It is very improbable, but it is possible that they accumulate. Of course, they accumulate, but then they roll down because of classical motion. That's why we need this diffusion equation, because it tells us what is the speed of accumulation of fluctuations and what is the speed of rolling down. And we can solve this equation, which is quite dramatic.
So this picture is when h is greater than m everywhere, so it really you're diffusing over the barrier.
Yes.
There's no tunnel.
Yes. And in this case, what happens? Where do you diffuse? Well, you diffuse, you come to the top in the place which comes there first. And there is the problem of the time of the first jump in statistical mechanics. And it can be shown there how it is related to these properties of diffusion equation. Because I kind of skipped it. I've shown you the static distribution and say this is a probability of tunneling. Okay. But there is really a link between the static distribution and the probability of tunneling. You just follow every Brownian trajectory and this distribution. Yeah.
You start red everywhere, and how many steps does it look like?
Well, it depends on the height of the barrier, and depends on. So, if, for example, your Hubble constant is larger than the difference between these two minima, it's just half a step, and you're already there. Okay. But what happens that eventually the speed of inflation becomes slower, so the jumps become smaller and smaller and smaller, and then you're stuck in the minimum. But here the main point is that it is not a homogeneous tunneling; it's just diffusion, and in one part, so your whole distribution becomes like that. And if at some place you move further than the distance from your minimum to the barrier, then it just falls. Okay, fall. You go to this place, and you fall. So this tunneling is, you have like an amoeba instead of spherically symmetric bubble, and then you fall down here.
Can I ask a question? What is the relation, if any, between these fluctuations that cause this eternal inflation and the ones that lead to structure formation and so on.
Right? Yeah. Okay. So if you are not very far from from the end of inflation, then these fluctuations, delta rho over rho, they are 10 to the minus 5. And there is no eternal inflation there. There are just these small fluctuations. If you go higher, you see there is a standard expression for the models of this type that delta rho over rho is proportional to the logarithm of distance, usually in some degree, depending on the model. Sometimes it's power, sometimes it's logarithm. In the m squared phi squared, it's logarithm in 1 degree. In lambda phi to the fourth, logarithm in some other degree. And here are some small parameters, say square root of lambda in lambda phi to the fourth. So then you will find out that when L becomes exponentially large, how much exponentially large? So that logarithm L becomes larger than 1 divided by square root of lambda, then delta rho over rho becomes equal to 1. And that is the place starting from which description of our universe in terms of Friedman space becomes impossible. So our universe becomes fractal, and you see it here. And that's kind of funny, because our goal in inflation was to, explain why the universe is homogeneous. We were able to explain that it is homogeneous due to exponential expansion. But then because we did not want entirely inhomogeneous universe, it was necessary to take into account fluctuations. And this mechanism which explains local homogeneity of the universe predicts that it must be globally 100% inhomogeneous. That's just from this equation, okay?
The diffusion process, you describe it as a one-dimensional process, but if you
have if I have many fields, it's multidimensional process.
So, for example, coming back to Willis' question, if one of these fields determines an expectation value of some coupling, then...
I prepared for these two. Let's consider... This is our paper with Garcia Belida in 93. Let's consider Brans-Dicke theory. And here we have R divided by effective gravitational coupling constant, which depend on the Brans-Dicke field. Okay? Brans-Dicke field is essentially massless field. Now let's add to the theory other field which is responsible for inflation. And we can study behavior of this theory in the case if inflationary potential like that. So it's quite an interesting story, actually can be studied analytically for this case. This is inflaton field sigma, this is Brans-Dicke field phi. And then you start here in this area, you cannot study things classically because you have two large quantum fluctuations. So it's Planckian density depending on running Planck mass. So here it is one value of the Planckian density, here is another one. So this is Planckian boundary. Starting from this, you can study everything semi-classically. Then when you study it, this is a classical trajectory. It's actually for two fields, it looks like an arc. So you start from this point and you come to this point, and here inflation is over, and here you have definite value of the field phi. And this field phi determines the effective gravitational constant. However, why do I start at this point? And what if I take into account quantum fluctuations? So quantum fluctuations are of two types. One is in this direction, and another in that direction. And because I will have eternal inflation here, I will have the scale field moving along this Planckian boundary for a long, long, long time. And then, in fact, you'll have even runaway solutions. So these solutions tend, if I slice it in normal time, then the solution is completely unstable. It runs to infinitely large Planckian masses, to infinitely large fields, because there the speed of expansion of the universe is unbounded from below. Okay, but then, if we skip this question of what is the measure of, so what is important, is that when you go here, even if you start at one well-defined value of the field, then when you arrive to this point, you can arrive to this point or to that point depending on where you are, well, jumping off. And as a result, our universe becomes divided into places with different values of Planckian mass. Now, what we are right now measuring, this distribution of effective of electromagnetic coupling, for example. So if these things come together, these parameters like Planck mass or other things, what we may see right now may be not time dependence of parameters, but maybe spatial distribution of parameters. Here and here we may have different effective alpha, different effective Planck masses. It's not that I am selling you this model right now, because it would be nice to have a good model of what is happening. But if it is really true that they are finding some time dependence of parameter alpha, I would say I don't know how you can get time dependence and also make it consistent with the fact that here on Earth we did not measure yet any time dependence with Oklo, whatever. Okay. But space dependence, that's just what is quite possible. So you can have space dependence on all of these coupling constants. And it is possible to find the probability distribution of that, except for it's not necessary, well, very informative. We studied this stuff. I will just show you, yeah. We played with this analytically and numerically, whatever. We studied all of this. But then the question is, if you change well, the way how you study it, if you study different time parameterization, then you will get a different answer. What was most important for me is just to check what are the possibilities. For example, sometimes back in 87, we together with my student Zelnikov in Moscow, we studied six-dimensional theory, where you have Young-Mills field, scalars, or whatever, so it's not a big stuff, but nevertheless. And we have found there that there are two types of stable compactifications. Well, one is no compactification at all, it's a six-dimensional space, and another one is four-dimensional normal compactification, and both of them were compatible with inflation. Now, if you write down equation for the logarithm of the radius of compactification, you will see that it is also described as an effective scalar field, which also experiences jumps during inflation. And as a result, if we start with four-dimensional compactified universe, you may locally decompactify it. And then our universe may become in part six-dimensional, in part four-dimensional. I've never found any way of making six-dimensional inflationary universe four-dimensional. I found only a way of making it, well, high-dimensional. That's apparently very common to string theory, where if you have four-dimensional, it has this desire to become 10-dimensional. So it is possible to have it locally in different parts of the universe. Then we started studying whether one can, well, solve these equations of a more advanced type, which I have shown you before. That is, not studying the probability of staying here at a given point. Because if you say you have inflation, you study a person at a given point, what is the probability that he will still inflate later? And the answer is zero, because, well, if you study, say, if you have a model like that, and you have a well, like delta functional distribution of probability in the beginning, then it starts broadening, and then it starts rolling down, and the fact that it broadens does not keep the maximum of the probability distribution anywhere. But the tail of the distribution is multiplied by e to the 3h time, okay? So if you study the probability distribution which take into account this broadening, then you find out that if your initial point was to the right of this critical value in the model which I've studied, it was this one, if you're to the right of it, then the distribution which take into account this extra factor moves to the right instead of moving to the left. And in fact, become very rapidly squashed in such a way that it maximum goes towards as large values as you can imagine. But then the question is, how far can this distribution run before, well, it runs its course? And here is the question, can you have, for example, inflation, even in this simple model, in this model m squared phi squared, do you have any natural self-cut for inflation to happen? And here is how I would analyze it. At least this is, a sketch of an idea. So what is these delta phi fluctuations which we generate all the time? They are proportional to h divided by 2 pi. What is the energy sitting on these fluctuations? Because these fluctuations, they look like that. The amplitude is h. The wavelength is h minus 1. So the gradients sitting on these fluctuations are h divided by h minus 1. So it is h squared. And the total energy is h to the fourth. Okay? Now, this gradient energy will become larger than potential energy when h squared is v divided by m Planck squared. So it is like that. Okay? So this quantity becomes larger than this one when v becomes larger than m Planck to the fourth. So even if you trust anything that happens at v greater than Planckian density, then you would not expect the inflation, because you will see here gradient terms beating potential energy. So it's like self-cutting of inflation, if you wish. So I would then study these probability distributions with the assumption that it cannot go beyond the field where which will be m Planck squared divided by m. And here is boundary of self-reproduction for this particular model.
I have never, ever believed that you have said there's a sense of electric physics with a simple form holding out such large field.
No.
But are we supposed to believe that the story is really generic? That any reasonably
smooth? No. You see, in this statement, in this estimate which I made so far, h to the fourth compared to m Planck to v. Here, I did not use any shape of the potential. So the assumption that there will be a cut is probably okay.
So as long as the density is stable at the Planck scale, this goes on forever.
Yeah.
That's production of black holes.
That's a different way of seeing it. Yeah. It's just when you go to the Planckian density, then whether you are, want it or not, you have a lot of stuff going on there. You do not expect inflation.
That's really true. The question is whether we can believe the story up to that point. I mean, how much of the story we can believe up to that point?
That depends what you believe in general. Because first of all, if you want to find out this simplest model, m squared, phi squared, or whatever, in string theory, you have a lot of trouble, because we didn't succeed of doing so far. I mean, in fact, however, you look at this model and try to find out its own self-contradictions, it's not that you are trying to find out whether this model follows from any fundamental theory. But you are trying to find out whether this model just internally wrong at large field phi, okay? Just cannot be right. For example, people would say that when field phi becomes larger than m Planck, then you do not trust this story, okay? Nevertheless, when you look at our KKLT paper, you will see the potential, the scale about 100 Planck masses, and nobody give anything about it. Okay. So in cases where you do not expect any internal reasons in the theory for breaking the approximations which you did, then you don't see anything wrong here. What is wrong with field phi larger than m Planck? Well, let's consider, for example, a theory which is just flat. I mean, the effective potential doesn't depend on anything. So this theory has a shift symmetry, phi to phi plus constant, and you do not see any problem with starting here or here or here. So in this case, field phi, if field phi does not have its own geometric meaning, which it might, like if you go to supergravity, then it may have some relation to curvature of space. If you have Keller with phi, whatever, this kind of stuff. So if you have geometry associated with the field phi, then its own value has some meaning. Potential, for example, will grow exponential, like phi squared. If, however, you have just theory of scale field, nothing, okay? If you do not think much about the origin of it in some geometrical theory, then you may argue field phi does not make any independent meaning at all. And then it can be very large. However, it cannot be very large if your field has potential like that. Now, if the field has potential, then the only boundary for the values of the field is that potential must be below than Planckian density. So this I understand. And this then leads to constraint. M squared phi squared must be smaller than M Planck to the fourth, which gives you the constraint phi smaller than M Planck squared divided by M, which can be extremely large. So what I'm saying that internally, if I'm looking at the model as a model, it doesn't have anything wrong in it. If you want to get it from something else, then it's, the problem of which we're still trying to address.
The problem getting it, say, from string theory is that these scalars tend to have an interpretation of decompactifying yourself.
For example, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. You must just in every given context you will find its own constraints, and in fact there will be even a problem to find any inflation, not to say about eternal inflation. Usually people who are talking right now about eternal inflation, so Alan Guth, etc., they say that eternal inflation is completely generic. Okay, this is not that simple. You can always have models. Like, for example, potentials of this type, which can lead to inflation, but then when you go to the region where eternal inflation would start, I have just a wall here. Or you may add to the theory terms like this phi squared r with a very tiny coefficient. And then when you go to very large values of the field phi, you go to the place where your Planck mass just blows up. And again, there will be no eternal inflation there. So if you want to not have eternal inflation, it's possible. What was surprising, that there are some very primitive models where you have it. Yeah.
Right. If you have that, you can just go to Einstein frame, right? And that rescales the potential by 1 over...
It depends. If you have only this, or if you have if you have just normal term, and everything depends what will be the relative science of this. Because here, if the relative psi is negative, then at some point it will imply that your gravitational coupling constant blows up. Okay. And this will be a singularity of peculiar type where actually the universe becomes extremely anisotropic.
I suppose it's not that sign. You could just go to Einstein frame and
If you want to just to exclude this kind of thing, this would correspond to going to a frame where potential, which was previously was normal, for example, m squared phi squared, this potential blows up, it becomes exponential and going exponential and then even blowing up like that. No. It's just in this frame it becomes. You change also the field phi, and this becomes exponential potential. So there will be some. It was some paper by Maeda and whatever about 15 years ago when they studied this kind of theories, and they found that you can make change of variables so that to exclude this term out of the consideration, but then your potential blows up. So it really, if you have no inflation, it is no inflation in whatever frame you do not have it. Now, what I want to show you more is this part. You see, I really was not even prepared for this large discussion, and I do not think that you would like me to tell you all details that brought us with Arthur Merleman in our paper of whatever it was in 93, 10 years ago, with the structures like that. When we studied this probability distribution, assuming that there is this upper boundary for inflation, so assuming that probability distribution wants to go
probability, volume weighted probability distribution, wants to go upwards toward very large values of potential energy because it speeds up inflation, but we assume that there is upper bound above which you cannot go. And in this case, you can obtain stationary probability distribution. Now, what was really strange in this probability distribution for me, and it took a lot of, well, just walking around and thinking, how could it be? What is the interpretation? This probability distribution, it depends on two quantities. Initial value of the field, final value of the field, and time. So what was interesting, that if you have stationary distribution, it in fact factorizes. There is a function which depends only on phi, there is a function which depends only on time, and there is a function which depends on initial conditions. This is something which you cannot explain in 10 words. It is just, you write down these equations in the box bounded from above, and you, well, use some methods which people who study the stochastic equation use, and you find out that in the limit of large time, this factorization occurs. And this factorization means the following. That first of all, whatever is initial conditions, whatever is the probability of initial conditions, once you start this regime, then the probability to find the universe in a state with a given value of the field phi does not depend on initial conditions. So if you want to study initial conditions, it's your problem. But if you want to study only the final result, you just look at the asymptotically large time and you find what it is. If you want to study with which speed these bubbles are growing, let me explain why the question. Suppose you have one state which is at very large energy density, so it grows with very large speed. Another state at smaller Hubble constant, it grows with much smaller speed. So it is natural to expect that smaller guys will grow with a smaller speed, so they will occupy smaller volume. Now, in this probability distribution,
but it's not a probability distribution.
Excuse me?
It's not a probability.
It's volume distribution. I don't say that it's normalized. Okay. It's volume distribution.
But it's not normalized.
Yeah, well, at every given moment, you start with some finite thing, okay? At every given moment, the volume is finite, so you can divide at every given moment the volume, but the whole thing by the total volume, make it normalized at every given moment of time. What was important? That is the factor with which all it is growing. You see, so if you start with finite volume, this is the overall factor. So the strange thing is that the small guys grow with the same speed as the high guys. Because we thought originally, and that was, well, I formulated it like a Darwinian approach to cosmology. These guys who inflate faster, they create most of the volume of the universe. So this is a way for us to study what is the most probable way to form the universe of our type. That's an option. Sometimes it may be the case. But what we have found in the case when the probability is stationary, not static, because there is this factor, but stationary, what happens? There are some leaders which bring you very, very high. Then these leaders produce branches. So you jump to these states which expand slow. So it is like, well, help, like society helping each other. There are some leaders, they accumulate a lot of money, and then they just give it, like, well, Microsoft. So in this case, society grows with the total exponential, that is, if you have stationary distribution.
That way the government's changed.
Well, yeah, so in the Brunz-Dicke theory, there is no such stationary solutions. There is a runaway solutions, but there is no upper bound for Hubble constant there because Planck mass can formally be infinite there. In the normal theory of gravity, yep.
I mean, here's a case where it really depends very much on what metric you use. There's the, because the Weyl transformation would turn it back into just a normal scalar field. So, I mean, in the Brunz-Dicke case, it's very clear that whether you use the Einstein metric or the Brunz-Dicke, the Weyl transform metric didn't give you a different answer.
I do not think that the final answer will be different. It's just a different way of studying the same thing.
But Brunz-Dicke is just a scalar field from another point of view. So why would that not?
Or with only derivative coupling.
results are rather restored,
right? No, I'm just saying you, the following, that in the Brunsdicke theory, if you take Planck, effective Planck mass as a function of the field phi, then there is no upper bound for effective Planck mass. If you say that your stationary distribution is cut, so inflation is not going on, at the Planckian boundary, then there is no Planckian boundary there. So your probability distribution will just run to infinite values of the Planckian mass if you trust it, unless you will introduce some cutoff into the theory, which is, of course, most probable. I'm just saying that in different models, you may have different animals here, but that is if you take normal Einstein. Here I'm saying the following. If you're going above Planckian density, then my gradient energy of fluctuations becomes larger than potential energy, and there is a self-death of inflation, or at least it's quite possible that this happens.
So it all piles up.
Yeah, so I'm going towards the Planckian boundary, and not only do I not trust to anything that you can calculate there, but there is also a reason to think that you cannot really penetrate this boundary, that there is a cut in the probability distribution. And in fact, when you solve these diffusion equations, you, assuming that there is a boundary, then you find that there is a maximum here, close to the Planckian boundary. But this position of the maximum, and that's the problem, the position of the maximum depends on the choice of the time parameterization. Because when I'm writing the, and that is the major problem of this approach, if I want to use it for calculation of the probabilities, if I want just to use it in order to understand that the universe just probes all of its states, which is quite a lot of interesting information, then that's enough for me. But if I want to introduce some probability distribution, then I will have a problem. And I explained this problem at the example of, well, this cone divided into two parts. This normalization constant, if I would normalize it, I would just drop this and drop that. I will retain only this one, this part. So I will have normalized the distribution. Everything would be fine.
That's not necessarily peak towards the
boundary. In the theories that we have studied, we have found the solutions, and the solutions are peaked near the Planckian density.
That's a co-moving distribution.
Sure. No, it's volume weighted distribution.
It's either the plus one or the
yeah. Whatever. What I wanted to say, yeah. Now, what it is here, this dH max, whatever. This is maximal value of Hubble constant. That is the value of the cutoff, okay? And if I would have just our universe expanding with a Planckian speed, I would have here like 3m Planck multiplied by t. But instead of that, I have this h max, which may be different from M Planck. And here I have d, which is a fractal dimension. So it is slightly smaller than 3 here. So it's really fractal, and you can calculate fractal dimensionality of this. There was a lot of work involved in studying this. We do not know which part of this work makes sense in the sense of finding the better probability distribution. And let me explain you on an example what do I mean by that. And that example is, well, of a sociological type. So
no, it's quite serious, and in fact, it's very painful. Great discoveries in physics have been done by the people 20 to 30 years old. Okay, that's just fact. Mm-hmm. Now, does it mean that we must retire already?
If we take each particular person, his own peak of productivity sometimes occur at much larger age. So why then we have these 20 to 30 years old? That is because,
at least until some recent time when the best people start going to computer science, the population of physicists was exponentially growing. So there were exponentially more young physicists than the old guys, which we still see in this auditorium, right? We're kind of, you know, in Rome, they have this definition of old people that is about 35 years old or whatever. And then there was dopantonos, which is the men which are good only for sacrifice. 40 years and older. So that's what we have here. Now, so that's a resolution of paradox here. And therefore, you may have two legitimate questions. One question is, what is
this statistically over the population, what is the most probable person who will produce you something great in physics?
And
also, you may ask a question about every given person. And both of these questions make sense. So when we cut this population of universes in different ways, it is just we are asking different questions. It's not that we are asking meaningless questions. If we know what kind of questions to ask, if we know what is the cut, which is for, well, specific questions you ask,
you get specific answer. So you get different answers. It does not mean that all these answers do not make any sense. Apart from, we need to learn what kind of questions should we ask in this situation. And this brings me to yeah, I do not afraid to pronounce this word. Okay, it's like this. What it was? The one who Voldemort. Okay. This is the list of all people working on anthropic principle in former Soviet Union.
I mean, a person was coming to our seminars and was talking about anthropic principle, and it was kind of a shame to hear what. It's really, really something strange. I mean, who can believe into it? Because there were obvious problems with
anthropic principle, and the first problem is that
it was ideologically very close to the just plain religion. Because it's like somebody creates a universe for our benefit, and you just wait until this somebody produces the proper universe for exactly you. Okay. Now, that was strange. And another thing, why this person needed to work that hard? Because if we just want to produce conditions sufficient for our existence, then it would be sufficient to produce nice conditions in the small vicinity of a solar system. So why would he work that hard to produce the same condition on all different parts of the universe? It just did not make any sense. Now, if now I have the universe producing all of its parts in all of its possible reincarnations, okay, then the first question goes away. It's not that somebody does it, it's just the universe does its self-reproduction. And the second question, why it was necessary to work so hard, because if you produce any kind of conditions in the small vicinity of a solar system, then they spread because of inflation on the observable part of the universe and beyond. So this simple objection to anthropic principle just dies away in this approach. And now we just started applying it to different kind of situations. This was one exercise which I made some time ago. And let's assume that we have a theory with potential like that. Very, very tiny slope, okay? Why not? I mean, this may be a pathological theory, but let's just play with it because it may give us some gain, okay? So suppose you have the scalar field, an extremely small slope. That's
kind of slope which is now considered normal, but by all people who now consider quintessence.
Because what we need is the theory such that if you stay here on the slope, you roll down appreciably only during the time which is large as compared to these 14 billion years. So if you have sufficiently small slope, now, why would you have a sufficiently small slope? If you have a theory which has this shift invariance, okay, so that the potential is just really absolutely flat, then you might have violation of this shift invariance by whatever non-perturbative effects. So you may have here exponentially small slope because of these effects. And I'm not trying to sell you this as a realistic something, but I'm trying to tell you that this is not any worse than any other models of dark energy considered. And in fact, this was the second model of dark energy. The first one was, in fact, suggested by Tom Banks. It was in his paper, CPT, whatever, in 84, 85. Well, so here is this situation. Now, this scalar field where it should be. Well, if you had inflation, then this inflation pushed this field around, and in different parts of the universe it occupied different positions. So there were some parts of the universe where it was staying exactly here, some parts of the universe where it was far away, and some part of the universe where the energy was even negative. Now, at the beginning, where inflation was, nobody cared about this small thing. But then when density of normal matter drops down, this become giving start giving the main contribution to the energy density of the universe. If you were sitting too high, then right now our universe would be inflating, and it would be inflating too fast. And my argument at that time was that if the density of the universe is, say, 100 times larger than the present density of the universe, then it would be absolutely empty. And then later, Steve Weinberg studied it more accurately and found that actually it would turn our galaxy. In fact, it's a little bit subtle, because our galaxy start being formed at the time when the energy density of the universe was pretty substantial. So in the center of our galaxy, we have density quite larger than the present energy density of the universe, million times larger. So it start being formed at that of the order of 10 or whatever. Density was very large there. But if we add there this cosmological constant is very large, then what happens that this galaxy, when it is formed in the process of its formation, it would not grow large. It becomes small, like a center of the galaxy. Because during the last 10 billion years or so, the mass of our galaxy, as far as I understand the experts, have grown maybe two times, whatever. Because, if there would be this cosmological constant, it would take these dwarf galaxies around our galaxy and it would throw them away so they would not fall onto ours. So it's not that our galaxy would be impossible, but our galaxy would be much, much smaller. And therefore, the average galaxy would be much smaller, and there would be a lot of material around in the universe which did not collapse yet. Now, of course, it did not even make up to the galaxy. And of course, you may argue, so who cares? It is sufficient for us to have some galaxies. Because the universe is infinite, then who cares whether it is large or not large percentage of it. So it's a tricky argument. It's not a precise statement that you cannot do this. But nevertheless, you probably cannot go much higher than, say, two orders of magnitude, three orders of magnitude greater than the present energy density of the universe, because other than that, then you will have just completely dwarf galaxies, only dwarf galaxies formed. That is probably not that good for life. So whether it is 1%, 0.1% probability, 10%, it depends on the person, and the persons are working right now on that. Now, if, however, you go downstairs, then the question becomes completely unquestionable. Because if you are here with negative energy density, then the universe just simply collapses. This is not anti-de Sitter space. This is, well, the flat collapsing universe with cosmological constant. So we have a bound, entropic bound on the cosmological constant. And that is as good as we can go. And we can, well, improve a little bit this bound depending on our assumptions of the probability distributions or whatever. So people are working on this. But this is one way of using entropic principle, which was quite interesting. Okay. Now, what other examples of using entropic principle that I am aware of? Well, let me just mention you some, which is not exactly entropic principle, but nevertheless. You know, I've heard about these constraints on the axion mass, that axion mass cannot be smaller than 10 to the minus 5 eV, and people are now getting hundreds of millions of dollars for creating the labs which would measure these axions with this 10 to the minus eV, because they know where to look. This is axion window. The axion mass is surrounded in the axion window. If you go to the left, you'll have some bad things in astrophysics with stars. If you go to the right, you have some bad things in cosmology. So what exactly bad things for cosmology would you have? Well, if you look at the axion potential, and if you take the typical value of it.
Well, I probably use a blackboard, because otherwise it'll take a lot of time to show. all this transparency here. So here is potential for the axiom field. It is just like tilted Mexican hat. And this is a maximum, and it is approximately at the height pi measured to the fourth. And this is a radius. And if the radius f axion is larger than this 10 to the 12, approximately GeV, then this mass corresponding to the Kirchhoff potential here, mass of the axion will be smaller than 10 to the minus 5. Now the height is approximately the same independently of what is FA in these simple models.
Okay, so what is the problem? The problem is that if you put your finger in any place here without thinking much, you calculate this energy density, which is this, okay? And then you look, what if this MA is very, very tiny? Then this field will be sitting here for a long, long, long time without losing its energy, because it would start oscillating only at the moment when MA becomes smaller than Hubble, sorry, becomes larger than Hubble constant. And Hubble constant is 1 divided by time in the normal expanding universe.
So if MA is very, very tiny, then it starts oscillating very, very late. Okay? And until it starts oscillating, it starts moving, its energy is this nuclear energy. So if, for example, I have huge FA, it would not even start oscillating right now. And right now, you would have natural value of energy equal to the nuclear energy. So it's clear that you will have some bound. And that is the bound that MA
must be larger than 10 to the minus 5 in order for it to start oscillating and to lose its energy during oscillations. Okay, that is assuming that you are not thinking and you are just putting your finger anywhere here and you say this is what is natural. Okay, so there was condition of naturalness embedded in the derivation of this bound on mass of the axion. Now, that's not my method. I mean, people were using condition of naturalness. And now I would like to check what is natural and what is unnatural if we include it into the context of inflationary cosmology. Because let me just expand this circle into the potential. Okay, so potential varies from plus m pi to the fourth. Oops, yeah. That's not what I want to show.
There's a field. This field distribution,
okay? This field distribution varies from this, well, from pi to minus pi.
Okay?
And if the field is standing here, it has very large energy. If it stays here, it has very large energy. It's not energy I've shown here. It's value of the field.
So in both cases, here and here, it would have pi meson, well, nuclear kind of energy.
Now, if we take very, very large value of the radius, you ask what is natural, and you put your finger here, or you put your finger here, and then you have a problem. But then I decided to check. What if we put our finger exactly here to this zero?
Then, of course,
zero, it has zero energy density. Now, you'll say, and I would, confer, that if you put your finger here, then it is much more probable still to put your finger in much larger area. So if you just move a little bit of this, then it is much more natural to be there. So I decided to check what does it mean much more natural from the point of view of observations, galaxies, and everything. So I've shown here by red, the value, well, the corridor of values of initial position of the axion field, for which you still have normal energy density that does not affect anything, I mean, safe region. And then let us increase it, say, 10 times. What will happen if I increase? Then the probability, naturalness, will be like 10 times more, simply because the phase space of putting your finger will be 10 times larger. And now I check what will happen if this field will have 10 times larger volume. So what will happen is the chain of events. First, energy will be ma squared multiplied by phi squared. So if you change phi 10 times, this energy density of the field grows two orders of magnitude. Now, the total energy density of the universe is the same. The universe is flat because it's inflation. You do not overclose the universe by axions. It was a wrong way of formulating the problem in the beginning. You do not overclose the universe. The total omega of everything is equal to one, period. But this omega is divided into parts, part in cold matter and part in hot matter, in photons. So when you increase by two orders of magnitude cold dark matter, correspondingly at the same time t, you make the universe colder, because at the same time t, you get much more in the cold matter than in photons. If the universe right now is colder, then it was, you see, there was some moment in the evolution of the universe where the density of cold matter became comparable to the density of hot matter. And starting from this moment, the evolution of galaxies started. So galaxies start growing seriously. Okay? So by changing this percentage of cold dark matter, you change it this moment in the past where this universe become cold dark matter dominated. And you change it considerably. And now the energy density of the universe is proportional to it is h squared, which is 1 divided by t squared. So if you change it this time, pushed it back in time, then the density of the universe at the time of cold-hot matter dominance, equivalence, will grow like t squared. And as a result, the density of matter in galaxies will become much larger. So what I found that if you change phi 10 times, the energy density in galaxies will grow 8 orders of magnitude. 8 orders of magnitude mean that your stars will collide every, whatever number of years. So there will be complete instability in our galaxy and probably very unsuitable for existence of life. So you get 1 order of magnitude gain from the point of view of phase space, and you produce completely different galaxies, 8 orders of magnitude more dense than ours. So then when somebody says that this is more natural...
In all fairness, the upper bound of the decay constant, there are easy ways to get around that. But in all fairness, the reason that people took this random place for the axial angle is that at temperatures above 100 MeV, the height of the potential reduces as a power. And actually, as the temperature goes above, it tends to zero rapidly. So it's actually a flat potential.
Completely.
And so you can put it anywhere you want.
But that's exactly what my point. If you have inflationary universe, you had originally this circle where every point was as good as any other. So during inflation...
Well, I'm not using inflation. I'm just telling you that when the temperature of the universe, in an FRW standard expansion, temperature was above 100 MeV.
Correct.
The potential went away as a power, and rather high power.
Correct.
So there was no specific place where you would put, it's completely random.
Correct. So what you had? You had angle, but the potential did not depend on the angle. So now, I mean, you had a complete Goldstone boson.
Yeah.
It was not, okay. So you had.
That was after inflation.
Yes. After.
It's the same relaxation.
Not only, okay, there are two Pichet-Quinn versions. The first one is that during inflation, you already had spontaneous symmetry breaking. You already have a Goldstone boson. And another one, you had Goldstone boson only after inflation. Now, what I am considering right now, a model of the first type, where during inflation, you already had spontaneous symmetry breaking and Goldstone boson. So because Hubble constant during inflation was higher than 100 MeV, then you really had completely Goldstonian situation. And therefore, this field with equal probability could sit anywhere. But if this field was sitting here, then it would produce a universe where you could not ask any questions, because the galaxies would be there, well, billion times more dense. So you can ask any questions about axions only in the galaxies in this region. So then when people say what is more natural, the question is what is more natural for what? What is more...
Okay, let me give you a simple way to get around this problem, that people invented 100 years ago.
I did.
If you dump entropy, live in a long list particle that dumps entropy and leaves the universe, it's sufficiently high temperature to you know, then the ball is completely
sure.
gone.
No. Look. Just tell it to these people who got, as I said, many $100 million for building their machines, which still did not find anything. And they were looking in the window. And I am saying that in inflationary cosmology, there is no reason to look in this window.
Are we actually close to the edge? Because like, if it was a little bit higher, there'd be more asteroids, and we'd be bombarded all, you know, instead of the one that killed the dinosaurs, they'd be every 10 million years. So you're saying we're actually sort of really on the edge of being too dense?
Shall we talk about dinosaurs too? because that's an interesting story. we cannot live in a too good universe with the galaxies that would be too low energy galaxies, because in such a situation there would be no asteroids which would kill dinosaurs, which will make our seminar here possible. Oh, he doesn't. That's.
I'm sorry. I just.
That's some dinosaurs are still here. Okay. Now. Look. You know what happened approximately 100 million years ago? There was this. How dinosaurs were killed? There was this asteroid which fell to the Earth, and it was flying near the Earth and killing everybody with a neck that stick higher than 10 meters. Now, but actually it was because of the explosion. So if there would be no asteroids falling to our Earth, then dinosaurs will probably still be around, and we would not be here. No, just he asked me a question about meteorites, etc. I answered.
Very strong anthropic.
Yeah.
Your conclusion is that outside this band, we are not supposed to consider what is outside this band.
I'm saying only. That if you say that it is natural for the axion field for us to live in the place where axion field has this initial value of energy density, which is nuclear energy density, I would ask you to check why do you say that it is natural? Because if you go outside of this bound, you happen to live in a completely different environment. It's not I am using anthropic principle, and I'm saying that those who use consideration of naturalness should explain their point of view.
But if somebody wanted to use the anthropic principle, then you would.
Yeah, then I would exclude these areas. Because, and now we are going to the definition of what is anthropic. Because. Okay. Shall I finish on the bigger? As it's getting. Unprofessional, yes. Just. But that's what it is. You see, the problem is that we are now facing the situation which was quite unexpected for some and quite undesirable for some others. There was always this idea that we are looking for one and the only solution of all equations, and then nevertheless, if you look at the bizarre parameters which we have. Like this electron mass, which changed two times, and life of our type would be impossible. And the mass of the electron changed two times, and life of our type would be impossible. And nevertheless, they look like a set of random numbers. So maybe our theory is so weird that these crazy masses appear like a unique solution of a great theory. This may be the case. But on the other hand, if we have really this possibility within the theory that spreads all of your options, like what we have here on Earth, we have here the dry Earth and we have here ocean, and we do not ask ourselves why don't we live in ocean and take the seminars there, because there are some others who live in the ocean. There's nothing profound in this. So anthropic principle in one form or another, it's bound to be correct. The question is how far you can go with it. And it's not necessary to insist that you can go very far. It just you use whatever it gets you, and you should be very accurate, because if you read the books on anthropic principles, sometimes Barrow and Kipler and others, sometimes what you read there makes sense, sometimes it does not. And if you have a scientific book which 70% of which makes sense, then it's a very bad book. So this is, yeah.
It's something that bothers me, whether anthropic or not.
Okay.
In either cases, you need solutions by anthropic. I don't think we have defined clearly a mathematical, precise question to which what you're talking about is the answer, or to which the unique solution is the answer.
But no, the unique solution, like, like nuclear level, the carbon levels in carbon, whatever it is, that need have to be there for the sun to shine. The carbon cycle to work, those are things which we've learned can be calculated.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And in the end, the proof of that is in the calculation.
Mm-hmm.
So I can imagine on the side of calculability, as physics has done in the past, all of chemistry, all of biology, all of life, we can prove the point by doing the calculations, at least in this case.
Yeah.
So you know that all the properties of water, for example, which are necessary for life.
Yeah.
Do you believe are anthropically selected?
Well, you surely know that the water exists in three different phases, right? And you
level,
do not live in a solid water.
At some level, as you know, I presume you believe that even though it hasn't yet been done, we can quantitatively explain with great precision why water has the phase diagram it does.
That's
or
true.
You don't believe.
That's true. But
it hasn't been done yet.
No.
Since it hasn't yet been done, there's a test.
Yeah.
Physics and the chemistry can explain the phase diagram of water quantitatively. Or if we couldn't, and we still haven't, it's a perfectly bizarre phenomenon that would be appropriate, but is much more than equal value with all these other things, to invoke the anthropic principle.
Well, but just a second. But no. You in your argument, you already mentioned something which is kind of self-defeating, because you said that you can explain phase diagram of water. This tells you that you have the same water, the same chemical thing, and it can be in three different states. So now there is water on Mars. We do not live on Mars because there is water in solid state there. Okay. So you have different kinds of water in different parts of the universe. So even though you may have one unique theory, then you may have different conditions in different parts of the universe. So you have question whether what we are trying to explain right now is fundamental or environmental. So our part of the universe may be good environment for the people like us and bad environment for somebody else. And I do not think that the goal of science must be to explain environment.
Obviously. But the question is, what parts of physics we're going to have to resort to the anthropic principle to place bounds, never calculate? And what parts can we actually calculate?
We don't know. We always should try to calculate as much
so
as possible.
I think that was the part of what he said. There is, in the case of calculation, at least I can give a precise definition of what the goal is and what constitutes success. We have many examples. We know what a successful calculation is, something that gets it at the beginning to order of magnitude and then gets better and better over time, sometimes achieving enormous precision. In the case of anthropic principle, I have no idea what constitutes a test. You know, if I get something within 2 orders of magnitude, it's good, that's a success. There's no hope of ever doing better.
It is possible to imagine, look, I'm agnostic about this question, I'm topical, no, I don't know. But it is possible to conceive and can set up a very precise set of questions, mathematically precise, to which the answer does not correspond to what we see in objects. And maybe a parameter that further on, that, you know, and you calculate again precisely. Although, with this set of parameters, I can reproduce something that looks. We're not even at the stage where we have a setup. Simply has not told us what to do in context that we've seen here. There is no precise formulation. All we've been doing so far is to extract some effective theories, playing with, you know, with universes which the asymptotic behavior we do not know.
And
we don't have precise formulas at all.
So let me just play with something, okay? Because, you know, sometimes the answer to the complicated question is like Buddhists ask the question, okay? So they answer in a different way, okay? Why mathematics is so efficient? And people ask this question for such a long time. Now, a better formulation is, why is mathematics why mathematics is so efficient in our part of the universe? Because if you have this stringy landscape or whatever landscape, there are some parts of the universe where the minimum of energy density is right now at nearly Planckian density. In this case, every Planckian time, you destroy all information you create. And therefore, there you have no memory about the previous events, about no possibility to predict anything. No, it's not your memory. It's just the possibility to produce any recording device.
And therefore, there's no mathematics.
Oh, mathematics is an ability to predict something on the basis of your previous experience.
Mathematics wouldn't exist without you.
Mathematics would not be useful. It's not the existence of mathematical structures, which is kind of abstract concept, which we may debate whether this abstract exist in our absence. This would bring us too far. What I'm trying to say, the question is, why mathematics is so useful? And the statement is that in the parts of the universe where quantum fluctuations are too large, mathematics would not help us to predict anything. And we live in the parts of the universe where we, like stable structures, became...
Well, you know, Wolfram believes that's true for all of us.
What?
He wrote it out in page book, you know, trying to say that. It should be, maybe.
So maybe, maybe. Then at the conference, which was dedicated to this 90th birthday
Andre,
of...
That explains nothing. All you're saying is, you're not answering the question, why is mathematics good at explaining the universe, or more precisely, why is the mathematics we use so neat and beautiful?
No.
You're explaining there might be situations where couldn't work even if it was there.
I'm saying
it couldn't work and that it wouldn't be useful. But they clearly
well, what does that have to do with
what
why
if
is
flat,
it useful?
I agree with you completely. What
I mean,
if it just gives you a flat probability
for life to exist if we have beautiful mathematics?
I agree.
No.
But we'll have Wolfram.
if you're mathematically a flat distribution, that would be useless for making any prediction. But the math would still be there.
Yeah.
Well, if
life doesn't require mathematics to be so beautiful.
That is incorrect, because our life requires periodicity. Our life requires time to work. Our life requires predictions to be made. Our life requires our carbon structure to be possible, etc. And this
requires
stability.
Very philosophical.
Oh yeah, and let me finish with something else. At the symposium, which was dedicated to the 90th birthday of Wheeler, I found that he had a very deep question, which I did not understand, know that it exists, etc. Why quantum? And everybody there at this symposium debated this, why quantum? And nobody have anything to say, why quantum, okay? So, I was surprised that this question exists because everybody knows that quantum mechanics. So I decided to check what does it actually mean. Well, so before discussing it, I would remind one question which was asked by Zeldovich some time ago, and that the question was, where do we have any experimental evidence of proton instability? Any evidence whatsoever for proton instability? And a normal person answer would be no, because we tried, and because proton did not decay so far with all these cavities. So there was no experimental evidence of proton instability? And the answer, which was given by Zeldovich, and I reformulated in a little bit different terms, the answer is that the evidence of proton instability is the fact that parallel lines do not intersect. And how would be, and okay, just watch me. Okay, just a second. Because if parallel, if we consider a possible set of universes, whatever, this could be a closed universe, it could be open universe. So in a typical non-inflationary universe, parallel lines would just diverge instantly or converge instantly. And the only theory that explains why our geometry is nearly Euclidean in the sense of textbook, okay? Why parallel lines remain parallel, the only theory is inflationary theory. Now, what inflation does? It takes previously existing baryons and make their density zero. And in order to produce new baryons, you need to have baryon instability. Therefore, the fact that parallel lines do not intersect is an evidence. What can I do? Okay. Now, why quantum then? Okay. So a typical universe, well, if you want to explain large universe, which would be homogeneous, et cetera, suitable for our life, you need to have inflation. Now, if you do not have inflation, then the universe is very, well, kind of inhomogeneous, bad for your health. If, however, you have a universe, inflationary universe, without quantum effects, then we would not produce galaxies, and in fact, we would not produce any particles, because all matter in the universe is produced after inflation. All particles from which we are built is produced after inflation. So the conclusion is that if we do not have inflation, we have a bad universe. If we have no quantum, we have empty universe. That's why quantum.
Just set the hydrogen atom wouldn't have been stable.
This is very anthropic because yes, without you call it whatever name you want.
A set of universes, some of which have quantum mechanics, some of which have something else.
Right.
Linda mechanics. Yeah. Some of which have classical mechanics.
Yeah.
Well, what are those other possibilities?
Yeah. As long as people consider different options, it's fine with me. And they may not use this A word. Okay. Just the question is why this H bar has its particular value?
No, H bar doesn't mean anything.
Then you need to compare it with the Planck mass or with some other parameters. And the
No. H bar.
Okay.
What are you comparing it with? Not the Planck mass, that's an independent dimension. Work in natural units. What are you comparing?
You have speed of light, you have Planck mass, and you have H bar.
Good. Those are all one. Now, what are you comparing H bar with? There is no, it doesn't make sense.
I don't think so. What's about this Bohr orbit, which really changes if you change H bar? It depends what you consider fixed.
You're right. So set H bar equal to 1, the units you always work with. Now you're considering the amplitude of some field. It's a large action.
No, I think that the problem is that if you really consider all of them equal to 1, then you just limited yourself for something that cannot change. And this is not the case, for example, in the Brunsdicker theory, it's not.
They are all equal to 1.
Excuse me?
You take ratios.
They're equal to 1.
Dimensionless ratios you can change. That's the only thing that counts.
Dimensional ratios.
Dimensionless ratios. That's what counts.
Andre, in the beginning of your talk, you explained what it means to have a semi-cross filament. You have some large occupation number, that's a pure number.
Okay.
So I'm not sure, what do you mean by an anthropic explanation of quantum mechanics? I mean, what it would mean?
So just, if you have all parameters, I'm not quite sure that you see, if you have inflation, if you have, for example, theory with a given, there are several different parameters which go in the package. And one of these parameters, for example, you have this theory m squared, phi squared. This is a parameter which is fixed. This delta rho over rho, which is proportional to m divided by m Planck. There are some things that that depend on the choice of these parameters. And if you change these parameters in such a way that, say, galaxies will be impossible, then you would be in a bad shape. So you should keep this m. This m.
That I can understand. There are various dimensionless parameters, but that doesn't pick out quantum universes.
I think that this depends then on your definition of what is parameter one. If you fix this, this will be one thing. If you fix m and m Planck, it will be a different thing. And we are talking only about things, about which parameters you allow to vary. But certainly you cannot take all of these parameters equal to one.
No, I can take h.
Dimension
for terms,
you can take to 1,
yeah.
But not dimension. You cannot take alpha to 1
or pi. That's the point. So you have this e squared divided by hc, and you cannot change its value.
You're allowed to change that. Physics.
That's what you're saying. I mean, that's the whole thing, right? You have different states, different vacua, different points where e squared over hc can take different values.
So then it's what you're saying that what you're saying that this is what you're saying is that when I'm taking h equal to zero, it's the same as to take e equal to zero. That I would also say that's essentially the same. If I have small coupling constants,
just saying both of us are meaning the statement. The only thing that you can adjust are these dimensionless parameters.
This one.
The only thing that are adjustable,
okay,
or changeable,
okay,
are dimensionless parameters. Now,
okay,
as you explained, there are certain regions where certain certain dynamical variables behave classically when their action is big compared to h bar.
Right.
Then you get a semiconductor. But you know, good, and you might have regions, as you explained, you know, the inflaton field can behave classically, stochastically, as it exponentially decays. That indeed happens. So then you have a classical approximation that becomes good. But of course, that doesn't mean you don't have quantum mechanics. It just means you have.
Well, I mean, in your language, if you fix it, h, this
you know around that semi-classical, that one variable which is big, are quantum mechanics. So I just don't think that there's any.
Well, maybe I should agree with you on this because if I just say that h equal to 1, then at this language, the change of h which I was changing is equivalent to change of e.
But changing alpha is not changing quantum.
Right. Right. I agree.
Can't you imagine
I don't think you can imagine, and people in the early years of quantum mechanics tried to, I mean, this is one of the things people tried to do in the early days of general relativity when they had problems quantizing general relativity. They said, well, if your general relativity is classical, and quantum mechanics is, you know, for everything else, except for gravity. And that is inconsistent.
Okay, but I don't think that was the.
I don't know what it means to have part, you know, one part.
Purely classical.
I think if you really set h back to zero, this is a different theory.
One back.
You can't turn off quantum mechanics continuously.
Everything depends on what kind of operation one want to take. One possibility is to keep h, c, and m Planck constant. Another possibility is to keep e squared, c, and m Planck constant. And that's usually what people have in mind, because they say, we have classical interaction of electrons. Let's assume that we know what it is e squared because we can measure it in the room. And this h, we measure in the room, well, after some effort. So what if we keep e squared, c is 1, and m Planck is 1, then h we may vary. Then, so everything depends on how you deform classical classical physics, either this way or that way.
So here you mean that there's no possibility for particle production, right? There's
I am saying yes. If you just change H, keeping all constants, all other constants, like coupling constant, fix it, then you will not have particle production and you have galaxy production. Just an example. For example, when we study baryogenesis in Afflig-Dyne model, the baryogenesis in Afflig-Dyne model depends on the angle between two fields there. Okay, this angle is random variable, which is different in different parts of the universe. If you take original Afflig-Dyne model, you produce a baryon number equal to 1, very, very large. If you consider the possibility that everything depends on angle, then exactly like in the axion example, you can live in the universe which is entropically selected to have delta to have n baryons divided to n gamma 10 to the minus 10. So you may have things where entropic principle helps you. It does not mean that you should try to use it every day. It just means.
When Tom gets here, we can have another discussion, because Tom actually thinks that not only is the entropy falsifiable, but it's falsified. We can continue this.
But in fact, the NV omega gamma is an example of what David Gross was asking for, right? Because this, with a better understanding of CP violation, gradient by theory, this is something we might eventually be able to calculate.
Yeah, maybe.
But couldn't it be that certain quantities don't depend just on the laws of nature, but on initial conditions? It looks to be very different if you say entropically you determine m electron over m proton, or whether you determine whether in this place in the universe m gamma over m baryon is so much. Looks to me a much weaker
state. Let us just distinguish the maximal goal. I'm just finishing and people can go. There is some maximal goal that you can predict everything that we see right now from one unified principle. There are low goals saying that you cannot predict anything because everything is entropically determined. I do not believe that this is right. And there's some middle road, and I think that middle road is something that we should take. What?
How do you decide, given something like the fine structure?
I do not want to decide a priori. I do not want to make an a priori decision that our universe must be unique. And until we have found this unique reason why it is so, we are just failures.
How do you decide the other direction? I mean, what use?
I do not think that we will be able to decide because we have a limited amount of experimental data.
If you find that some change would have made the universe more hospitable than it currently is, how do you argue that that isn't natural and are not having achieved that more hospitable environment?
Look, that's a good question, and there is no answer. And there is no answer until we understand something else. Let me just give you an example, which I actually used quite often. There are much more Chinese than Americans. So does it mean that it is impossible for us to live here? Because if we just use some very, very naive probability, and people coming from New Zealand also. So you can use anthropic principle in a very naive way, and we do not really know how to use it precisely, especially when we go to the point of calculating probabilities.
Sure.
So we do not know it. The only thing that I'm willing to suggest or to propose to use, in fact, is that sometimes we have this just choice of different options, and quite often it happens. So you can be in the geometry of this type and can be in geometry of that type. Sometimes you have this inflationary, this string theory that does not allow inflation, and sometimes you have a version which does allow inflation. In this case, I say we see that universe is inflationary. So should I say that if out of 100 models of string theory, I will have only one that allows inflation, and this would be, I would say, this would be very optimistic, okay? So should I say that we have a disastrous situation, that we should actually rule out inflation, string theory by the very fact that it's very difficult to find one that gives you inflation? And I would say if out of 100...
Why do you say that string theory is incomplete, that there's some new extra thing that is...
Maybe, or maybe we should say that if out of 100 versions of vacuum states, we have one that gives you inflation, that is quite sufficient, because all other states which don't give you inflation produce a bad universes where you cannot live.
That really bothers me, because the history of physics shows that physics always, you know, there's been progress in physics, right?
Right.
I mean, at one time you can give an anthropic argument for why the gravitational force is 1/r².
Right.
It's inverse square, but we now have a deeper understanding.
Right.
We know it comes from field theory.
Right. I agree.
Yeah, but if you...
But that picks up three dimensions.
It was not
a danger with the anthropic principle that you keep bad theories. That, like, you suppose string theory really made a proper prediction about the probability of inflation and came out with the result, or the amplitude of density perturbation, something you really measured.
Yeah.
And it came out with there being, you know, less than a 1% chance of the observed amplitude.
Right.
Isn't that the point at which you have to throw the theory out, rather than say there's an anthropic reason
well,
to keep it?
So let me give you an example. When we were finishing our large paper of 6 authors, I suggested my collaborators to write something like that in the end of the paper, that the fact that it is very difficult, so difficult to have inflation in string theory, does not really completely disprove string theory. And they were not willing to accept it. And they were quite happy when I told them, but actually we have 1% probability and anthropically it's okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the situation right now.
But the situation is that you don't actually know it's 1%. You 1 out of 100 and you don't.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Okay, you're not in the position. I'm not saying you're in a position to do that. Yeah. But, I mean, something like the Petrikin axiom. I mean, there is a theoretical construction where you say there is a random value for the the bed. You know, so you really can say there's less than a 1% chance of it being so close to zero.
Exactly.
And if, if you can make observations, you can rule out that theoretical model which said, if the observation comes in, is only 1% of the theoretical prediction, surely you have to rather than say the universe is the way it is, and you must be in that.
Now, if you find axion in this axion window, is it what you mean?
Yes, that's
by,
right. I mean, that sounds to me,
so
the axion to be that question,
indeed.
To be wrong, to me that says, right, you were wrong to assume that it had a random value.
Yeah, indeed, if you find out axions within the axion window, then it would be really cool, because it would be a theoretical prediction of a certain range. However, if you take, every other model of string theory and you find the axions with a typical radius 10 to the 18 GeV, then it smells really bad. So is it really bad, or it is anthropically allowed? Of course, the axions are different, but I'm just giving an example.
Yes, but if theta was very small, you would be saying, wouldn't you look for an expert? You wouldn't be happy with just saying there's an anthropic reason why. Yeah, it has to be that.
No, I think his point is very, very well taken, that the anthropic principle encourages you to keep bad theories. That I think that's really.
I think that this is a right, but
imprecision doesn't.
Yeah.
Precision makes no difference.
Right.
I think that this is a right but incomplete attitude.
Really?
And because one thing that we should not stop, if we say have only anthropic explanation, we should not stop.
Right.
But on the other hand, if we have limited experimental data, which we, which is our present situation, and if we do not have any better explanation but anthropic, it does not mean that we are in a disastrous situation.
Well, let me give you an example of what he's saying, right? Suppose if we didn't understand gravity in the days before we understood gravity, we could have said that we would give an anthropic argument for the flat Earth, right? Because it would be very bad for humans if the Earth was round. We would all fall off. So there's an anthropic proof of the flat Earth theory.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just so many examples like this.
Yeah.
Imagine.
Well, let me nevertheless make a prediction.
Okay.
My prediction is that percentage of physicists uh-huh. who are going to use anthropic principle in the future, independently of the discussion right now,
right.
is going to grow.
Well, that's a statement of sociology, because
science.
It's very easy
yes.
for me to write a paper.
Yes.
Because
the opposite point of view can be productive only if physics has a growing experimental base. And if not, we will be forced sometimes to just to understand limits of our explanatory abilities.
David is making
a I don't think that we're going to converge into anything. I just
There is a way of refuting, as we've said, there is a clear-cut way of refuting any anthropic argument by calculating.
Right.
I can see about improving non-anthropic arguments.
Sure.
Argument.
For example,
anthropic arguments are always at the level of a few percent.
For example, at the moment when you...
Here with 1% probability, that's compared to the Chinese.
At the moment when you calculate the value of cosmological constant equal to 10 to the minus 120, probably many people who like anthropic principle right now more than before, probably many of them will give up. Until you do so, it is better to have one single explanation of this number, which is anthropic. We do not have any other explanation of this number at the moment.
Not to argue the other side, but that calculation will have some assumptions built into it.
Which calculation?
The calculation that you hope that one day will be carried out that gives a tiny cosmological constant. It's going to have some assumptions. It's going to be based on some theoretical structure, it's
sure.
got some initial conditions, and we can always say why that theory, and then you can say, well, anthropically. Because if it wasn't that theory and it wasn't those initial conditions, then the calculation wouldn't have given 10 to the minus 120, and then we wouldn't...
So maybe even in this case, the anthropic principle would not give up.
But I'm
saying that so far, the only explanation of this number is anthropic. And that's a sad situation, but it is the situation. But if we would not have even anthropic explanation for cosmological principle, then I would be much more upset than present.
Why? We just don't understand it, right? At the same time. At one time, we didn't understand why the electrons did not crash into the nucleus.
No.
We don't invent an anthropic argument for that. We invent quantum mechanics.
No, when you say...
The argument is only satisfactory
right,
if it can be provable or falsifiable.
Look, if string theory has all these vacua, it has all these vacua, and we have to live with it.
We don't even know what the definition of the vacua.
Okay, you know better than that. Many of this potential that you say doesn't exist is a well-defined thing in the low-energy effective field theory over much of field space. You know what that means.
I would really be interested returning to this question about Earth and everything. I would be really interested somebody proving on the at the level of fundamental theory that we must live on the solid Earth. It's impossible. We live on the solid Earth because we can live only on the solid Earth. We cannot live in the interstellar space despite the fact that the volume is much larger there. So there is something there which is really related to our own existence. And that's plain and simple.
Well, it's like saying we can't walk because we have 2 feet.
Right.
Maybe we could have had 3 feet. We walked.
Yeah.
Sure.
We out there.
So anthropic... Yeah. So
why don't we have
you just other beings making the same argument about why they're not living on Earth?
Right.
And those guys plasma clouds.
Right.
The other thing that perhaps would help if the anthropic principle predicted in, together with the value of the cosmological constant, some other correlated numbers.
That you can measure.
Right. Right. This for example, so one of the opposition or the points against the anthropic principle is designed to determine just a single number. If it could determine several others,
it depends how you take it. Come on, here it's particularly quantum mechanics. It's not just.
But in the formulation that I know, for example, in the some recent papers of Milenkin, when he tries to employ this quantitative.
This depends on the choice of the measure. Okay. Let's be clear about it.
Right.
So when you make it numerical, you're at risk.
So.
And his prediction originally was you have omega lambda 0.9, most probably. But then it also was like tendency instead of statement. The probability 90%, it's less than two sigma prediction.
You know it's going to vary there, all the coupling, right? So, you know, what about the fine structure constant? You want to calculate that?
We know that if you keep H and C and everything, if you change fine structure constant, yeah, we would not be here. Life would be impossible.
What? Well, it's a big range, right? We know there's a big range of fine structure constants.
For alpha, for existence of life, I believe you change electromagnetic coupling constant about two times, and life would be impossible.
Really?
Yeah. So this was actually one of the set of strange reasons. If you change many fundamental parameters, just a little, then life of our type would be impossible. So that is why it is so difficult to believe.
The remarkable thing is it's not clear ahead of time what are the fundamental parameters. As I said, before we understood the laws of chemistry.
Don't call them fundamental. You just
millions and millions of fundamental parameters characterized the behavior of materials.
Okay, I guess.
How do you decide?
Well, this is a serious. This is a scientific question, right?
Which one?
How many parameters? For example, if you define an anthropic probability distribution, how many variables do you put in?
But you see what you're doing right now. You're already on the way of studying anthropic principle. That's what happened at Stanford, for a long time. I was there alone, and then we started discussing it. And then. Like, warm. What?
I'm just wondering where I got. Did you affect Raphael? Is that the order of transmission?
No. About Raphael, in fact.
Yeah.
I think that this could be, the way how it infected, he infected you a bit, yes. Right.
Yeah. It's just like this movie, 28 Days Later.
Yeah.
Later.
That's a movie.
You don't know this movie? As soon as you infect it, you want